respectfully. Every single element of this land, right down to the bedrock, was a citizen of the community they all made together. And they all had legal standing. And they all made a good living. And they all had everything it took for total well-being for everything. That's what it was like. Hey, Jeff. Jeff? Well, the end, I guess. Because Jeff is now lying there, peacefully snoring. The story has put him to sleep. A kind of lullaby, it has turned out to be. A tale for children. And then, because Jeff is asleep and cannot see it, Mutt puts his face in his hands and cries.
Part 5. Escalation of Commitment. As a free state, New York would probably rise to heights of very genuine greatness, said Mencken. Bedrock in the area is mostly gneiss and schist, then a widespread overlay of glacial till. Minerals to be found include garnet, beryl, tourmaline, jasper, muscovite, zircon, chrysoberyl, agate, malachite, opal, quartz, also silver, also gold.
A. Stefan and Roberto. Stefan and Roberto were subdued and even apprehensive on the day they joined Vlade and his friend Adelba on our tugboat. They had agreed to take Mr. Hexter, and that turned out to be a lucky thing. As with him along, there was a certain amount of caretaking they needed to do. Without him, they would have had nothing to do. And the whole point of their expeditions was to do things. But they were out of control of this one. And the stakes felt kind of high. It was hard not to worry. Adelba picked them up on the 26th aquaculture dock next to the Skyline Marina, and as her tug grumbled up to them, the boys stared at each other round-eyed. Her boat was huge. Out on the ocean, they had not perceived that. Not container clipper huge, but city huge, as long as the whole dock, meaning 70 feet long, and about 3 stories tall at the bridge, with broad flaring taffrails and a squared-off stern.
Wow, Mr. Hexter said, peering up at it. A carousel tug, and named the Sisyphus. That's very cool.
Adelba and one of her crew opened a passage in the side of the hull and lifted over a staircase on a hinge. The boys helped Mr. Hexter up it and onto the tug, then up narrow stairs to the bridge. Adelba appeared to have only one crew member aboard, a man who nodded to them from the wheel, which was set in a broad console at the center of a big curve of window, the wheelhouse. The view of the East River was amazing from this high up. Vlade came up with Adelba after they had cast off, and the tug's pilot, a skinny black man named Tabo, pushed the throttle forward and they shoved upriver. Ebb tide meant nothing to this brute. It had more than enough power to get upriver at speed. Given how heavy and squat it was, the speed was kind of awesome.
No chance of hiding this baby,
Vlade remarked when he saw the looks on the boys' faces.
We're just going to have to sit there and be obvious.
People poke around the Bronx all the time, Adelba said. No one will give us a second glance.
Do we have a permit? Mr. Hexter asked.
To do what?
To dredge in the Bronx. Didn't that used to be off limits without a permit from the city?
Yeah, sure. That's still true. But my permit is good citywide, so if anyone asks, we'll be fine. And the truth is, no one is going to ask. The river police have enough to do.
Both of them, Vlade added.
Adelba and Tabo laughed at this. The boys' inclination toward secrecy relaxed, and they began to feel more comfortable. Adelba invited them to go down to the main deck and wander around. Mr. Hexter said it was okay to leave him up on the bridge, so they flew down the stairs and ran around the deck to see the water from all perspectives, particularly the white V of their wake, curling away from the deep white trough behind their broad stern. The power of the motor vibrated their feet, and it was thrilling to feel the wind pour through them, especially after racing forward to lean over the bow and look down at the stiff bow wave skirting up over the brown blue of the East River.
"This has got to be the most powerful machine we have ever been on," Roberto said. "Feel that motor! Check out this bow wave! We are killing this river!"
"I sure hope we find something today," Stefan said.
"We will. The signal was strong, and we were right on top of it. There's no doubt about it."
"Well," Stefan said dubiously, "there is some doubt."
Roberto refused to accept this, shaking his head like a dog.
"We found it! We're right on top of it!"
"Hope so."
As they approached their buoy, they spotted the snag it made on the surface and pointed it out to the adults up on the bridge. The tug cut back and canted to a new level, which left the bow distinctly closer to the water. After that, they hummed on like more ordinary craft.
"There's no way our buoy will anchor this beast," Stefan pointed out.
"True," Roberto said.
When the tug came up to the flaw on the river, and they could see their buoy riding down under it, Tabo came down and pushed a fat button on the bow that apparently released an anchor, and it must have been a monster in its own right, because when it hit the bottom, the bow lifted up again almost as far as it had when going full speed. The muffled rattle of the anchor chain stopped, and Tabo waved up to Idelba on the bridge.
"What if the anchor gets stuck down there?" Roberto asked Tabo.
Tabo shook his head. "She looking at the bottom with radar. She put it down someplace nice. Seldom a problem there."
The Sisyphus floated on the ebb and then dipped in place, indicating that the anchor was holding them against the flow. Idelba cut the motor, and then they were floating at ease, on anchor over their sight.
"Man, I wish I could go down again," Roberto said.
"No way," Stefan said. "It wouldn't do any good."
"We'll see what you got down there," Tabo promised.
Idelba and Vlade and Mr. Hexter came down to the deck, and Vlade helped Idelba and Tabo deploy the dredge tube over the side. Vlade got Roberto and Stefan involved in moving the segments of the tube to the rear and latching them onto the long snake they were making. It was about 4 feet in diameter, and its nozzle was a giant circular steel maw with claws like ice axe tips curving in from its circumference like marks on a compass rose. When they had about 30 feet of tubing screwed together, Tabo attached the nozzle end to a cable, then pulled it up to the end of a hoist arm by pushing buttons on the hoist mast. The boys helped crank the hoist around until the arm at the top had pivoted out over the water, taking the nozzle with it. Then Idelba let the nozzle cable down by pushing another set of fat buttons, and the tube and cable disappeared down into the murk, nozzle first.
"Here, come check this out," Vlade said to the boys.
Idelba and Mr. Hexter were regarding a console that featured 3 screens. The tube and cable appeared on all 3 screens as a kind of snake dropping to the bottom, clear in the sonar and radar images, murky in the light of the underwater lights that Idelba had dropped on other cables, running off reels suspended over the side of the boat.
"Is that your diving bell?"
Idelba asked, pointing to a conical shape on the bottom.
"I guess so,"
Roberto said, struggling to comprehend the image.
"I guess we left it behind after Vlade got me out of it."
Idelba shook her head darkly.
"Crazy kids," she said. "I'm amazed you're still alive."
Roberto and Stefan grinned uncertainly. Idelba was definitely not amused, and Mr. Hexter was looking at them with alarm. Out there in the wind and sun, he looked like he must have years before.
"We'll move that little death trap out of the way and get the suck on," Idelba announced.
She and Tabo worked their remote controls, manipulating the equipment in the murk as if they were down there seeing everything, if not perfectly, then at least well enough to bonk around and get done what they wanted. Vlade was helping them on the sonar and radar, obviously very comfortable with all the gear. Roberto and Stefan glanced at each other and saw they both were feeling far out of their league, but still in their element. This was how it was done. This was stuff they wanted to learn. Mr. Hexter was leaning over them with his hands on their shoulders, taking in everything and asking questions about what they were seeing down there, and noting things he saw that they weren't sure were really there, but it was cool. He was obviously into it. Idelba used one of the nozzle's hooks to lift the boy's diving bell off the spot where Roberto had almost dug his own watery grave, as the old man put it. When that was placed well to the side, she returned the nozzle right to the red paint Roberto had put on the asphalt, which in the murky monochrome on the screens looked gray and ghostly. But that was okay, because now the nozzle's hooks extended into the asphalt around the hole, and Tabo flipped a switch, and the grinding of the nozzle's drill teeth cutting into the Bronx came out of their end of the tube with a sound they could hear in their guts. Stefan and Roberto looked at each other wide-eyed. "That's what we needed," Stefan said.
"No lie," Roberto said. "And to think we were going to hit it with a pick." "A pick you couldn't even raise above your head without dinging the bell." "I know, it was crazy." "That's what I kept telling you."
Roberto grimaced and rubbed the screen of the radar, as if that would clear the view of the bottom, now obscured by a flow of junk clouding the water. Idelba said,
"Gentlemen, the dredge is gonna start sucking up whatever's down there. I'm aiming it at the metal you discovered, which shows on my metal detectors too, so good work there. It'll get real noisy when I turn the vacuum on, and what comes up at this end will run through sieves. We won't be able to hear each other, so if you see anything come out on the deck, wave so I can see you."
By now she was shouting, because the whine of some motor or engine far louder than the previous motor was now screaming from the deckhouse under the bridge. It was so loud that it seemed possible that the entire tug was filled with whatever machine was running there below the deck. The vacuum cleaner from hell. Now they all had to shout right in each other's ears if they were going to hear each other. But as most of them had their hands over their ears, this wasn't going to work either. Tabo dug in a locker and brought out big plastic earmuffs for them all to put on. And after that, things were much quieter. But they could only wave at each other. The boys stood with Vlade and Mr. Hexter at the upper end of the dredge tube, and when it began to spew mud and gunk into a big box on the deck, they leaned over the box and inspected the brown and black flow. The familiar stink of anoxia filled the air, one of the smells of the city here at its nastiest. They all wrinkled their noses and continued looking. Mud flowed down and out of a big meshed hole in the box, into a channel in the deck where hoses added water to the mix, and everything ran down the channel toward the stern and out a meshed gap back into the river. Vlade put on rubber gloves that went up to his elbow, then a dust mask over his nose, and began to finger through the mud in the box. It was obvious he had done this before. A black plume of mud blossomed off the end of the tug as the vacuuming proceeded. The anoxic stench was pervasive and ugly. After about 10 minutes of this, Idelba flipped a lever and the noise ground to a halt. Tabo and Vlade uncoupled the last section of tubing and began rooting around in the last tube. They dug out chunks of God knew what, put it under the hoses running into the channel on the deck, checked out whatever was revealed when the coating of mud was washed off, and then casually tossed what they had in hand overboard. Usually it was lumps of concrete or asphalt, sometimes soggy wood, which they inspected more closely. Other times broken stones, or chunks of what looked like ceramic. A goat's horn, a complete furry body of a raccoon or skunk maybe, giant clam shells, a big square bottle not broken, a fishing gaff, a drowned doll, many broken stones. When the tube was cleared, they began vacuuming again. Idelba guided the nozzle at the bottom, the old man looking over her shoulder intently. It was hard to believe he could interpret the blobs on the screens, but he seemed as interested as someone who knew what he was looking at. The noise was again incredible. The mud flowing through the box had nothing in it of any interest. Again the tube clogged. Again they cleared it by hand. Most of what they washed off now consisted of rounded stones, often broken, frequently shaped like giant eggs. When the vacuum was off, Mr. Hexter said to them,
"That's glacial till. Most of Long Island is made of this stuff. It was left here at the end of the Ice Age. Means we've reached the old river bottom, maybe.
Idelba nodded as she poked through the muck.
Unless you hit bedrock, you're always dealing with till. Nothing else around this whole bay except a little scrooge of soil on the land and mud under the water. Or landfill of various kinds. But mostly it's till.
After another clog was cleared, they went back to it. But before the vacuum began its whining and screeching and roaring, Mr. Hexter said to Idelba,
"So will you be able to tell when you're as deep as that metal you detected?"
She nodded, and they were back to it. Two clogs later, they suddenly found themselves sorting through old fragments of wood, squared off and lathed to something like spars or thwarts. Everyone looked at each other wordlessly, eyebrows raised, eyes round. Pieces of an old ship. Yes, these seemed to be pieces of an old ship. Back to another round of vacuuming with renewed interest, no doubt about it. The boys were hopping around looking at every lump in the channel on the deck, mostly stone after stone, pebble after pebble. Then, in the middle of the glaucous cronking of the upsuck and the huge whine of the vacuum pump, a big clunk stopped everything. Something had hit the last tube filter hard. Idelba turned off the vacuum pump. They all took off their earmuffs. Tabo and Vlade delinked the tube from the box, and they began to dig in the muck caught on the tube's filter. Against the big mesh, they found a wooden chest with a curved top, about 2 feet on a side, bound by strips of crumbly black that had colored the wood adjacent to them. Vlade tried to lift it out by himself, and couldn't. Tabo joined him, then Idelba, and they hefted it onto the deck, dropped it with a thump. Stefan and Roberto danced around the adults, crawled between them, sniffed the dead stench of the wet, muddy wood. It was the smell of treasure. Tabo picked up a short, flat crowbar and looked at Idelba. Idelba looked at Mr. Hexter. Hexter nodded, grinning widely.
"Be gentle," he said. "It should be easy."
It was. Tabo tapped the shorter end of the L into the seam between the box's top and its side, next to a black metal plate that must once have included the box's handle and lock. Now it was just a knobbly mass. A few wiggles, a gentle lift, a scrape. Tabo twisted the crowbar and levered it up again. The top of the box came up with a liquid scrunch. And there in the box was a mass of coins. Slightly black, slightly green, but mainly gold. Gold coins. They all cheered. They danced around, howling deathly at the sky. It was great to see that the adults were just like Stefan and Roberto in this, that they still had that capacity in them, even though grown up.
"There should be two boxes,"
Mr. Hexter said loudly in response to a look from Idelba.
"That's what the manifest listed."
"Okay," Idelba said. "Let's dig around a little then. They were probably near each other to begin with."
"Yes."
So even though the boys were hopping around, slapping hands and hugging, the adults turned on the vacuum again, and they all had to get their earmuffs back on and go through it all again. It was crazy. Stefan and Roberto stared at each other with their can-you-believe-this looks. But crazy or not, after a couple more vacuuming sessions, there was another big clunk, now characteristic and obvious, and they stopped the vacuum, unhooked the tube from the capture box, and lo and behold, another wooden chest. After that, Idelba still continued to dig around for a while, amazing the boys further, and even Mr. Hexter. Vlade just smiled at them, shaking his head. Idelba was nothing if not thorough, his look conveyed. In one break to clear the filter again, he said to them,
"She's going to suck up the whole South Bronx, I'm telling you, just in case whatever. We may be here all night."
Then they heard some slighter chunks coming from the deck, and they began to find black cup shapes, rusted knives, and a couple more pieces of ceramic, all rolling around in the muck at the bottom of the box, or sliding down the channel in the deck. The smell was sickening, but none of them minded. Everyone had their rubber gloves in the mud and water, washing stuff off under the hoses like prospectors. After about an hour of that, they stopped finding anything that seemed like it was part of a ship. It was back to stones and pebbles and sand. That same glacial till. The primordial stuff of the harbor's shores. Finally, Idelba turned off the vacuum yet again and looked at the old man.
"What do you think?" she shouted.
They were mostly deaf at this point.
"I think we've gotten what's there to get," Hexter exclaimed. "Okay," she said. "Let's go."
On the way back down to the 26th dock, they all stood around in the wheelhouse talking excitedly about the discovery. Mr. Hexter inspected some of the coins and declared them the right kind for the Hussar to be carrying, as only made sense. They were usually half-coated with a greenish-black crud, but where they had been touching, they were a dull gold color, and Hexter brushed a few clean with a wire brush and declared they were mostly guineas, with a few examples of other kinds of coins. They gleamed in the bridge's light like something intruding from another universe, one where the gravity was heavier. When they held a coin in their fingers and rubbed it, it felt like something twice as big at least, more like four times as big. The heaviness was very palpable.
"So whose are they?"
Roberto asked, looking at Vlade. Vlade saw the nature of his look and laughed.
"They're Mr. Hexter's, right?"
"I guess so."
Roberto did not have a poker face, and his crestfallen expression made the others laugh.
"It's right," Stefan pointed out. "He's the one who figured out where it was."
"But you're the ones who found it," the old man said quickly. "And these fine people here dug it up. I think that makes us a consortium."
"There's a legal routine for this kind of thing," Idelba said, frowning. "We use it sometimes down at the beach. We have to report certain kinds of fines to keep our permits good."
None of the others looked happy about this. Not that Idelba did either. Stefan and Roberto were appalled.
"They'll just take it away from us," Roberto objected.
The adults considered this. It was obviously not unlikely.
"I could ask Charlotte," Vlade said. "I would trust her to be on our side."
The boys and Hexter nodded at this thought. As they slowed down to approach the dock, they were all frowning thoughtfully. Before they reached 26th, Tabo said something to Idelba, who called Vlade over to the scanning screens.
"Look, Tabo saw this while we were digging."
She tapped around and pulled up the screenshot she wanted.
"This is our infrared, on one of the cables that we sent down with the dredger tube, so it's seeing hot spots at the bottom. And look here. On our way back from where we were digging, there was a rectangular hot spot on the bottom."
"Subway entry?" Vlade asked. "Those are still hot."
"Yeah, it could be Cypress Avenue, right? That's where it maps. But it's hotter than most subway holes, and rectangular. It's about the size and shape of a container from the old container ships. And see, the radar shows there's a whole parking lot full of those containers a few blocks away, behind the old loading docks. It just makes me wonder if this is one of those. But down in the subway hole? And hot as it is?"
"Radioactive contents, maybe?"
"Christ, I hope not."
"You don't have a radiation detector on board?"
"Shit, no."
"You should. There's a lot of crazy stuff in this harbor, you know that."
"Yeah, well, maybe I should."
"It's not a case of what you don't know can't hurt you."
"I know that. Although I was kind of hoping it was."
"Not. But yeah, this is weird. I'll have my friends in City Water take a look."
"Good. You're still in touch with those guys?"
"Oh yeah. We have poker night once a month. I usually make that."
"Good. I'll be interested to hear what they find out."
"Me too."
Roberto was still focused on the gold, so now he interrupted them.
"What are we going to do with the treasure right now?"
Idelba and Vlade regarded each other.
"Let's get it into the Met," Vlade suggested. Let me off at 26th and I'll sky over and get my bolt. And we'll take this stuff with us into the building and I'll put it in the big safe. Then it'll be safe while we figure out what to do with it. That could be tricky, now you mention it.
It was tricky before he mentioned it, Idelba said.
She looked at Tabo, who nodded.
Okay, she said. I know you'll take care of us.
Vlade nodded.
Of course.
We're a consortium, the old man said. The Hussar Six.
They agreed to that with handshakes all around, and Tabo turned the tug up into the flow of the East River and brought them up to the 26th dock. The river and the city looked like something out of a dream.
Man sits on a bench in Central Park, middle of a hot summer night, 1947. Another man sits down on another bench across the path. Hey, how are you? Good. How about you? Hot night, eh? Too hot. My apartment's an oven. Mine, too. So what do you do? I'm a painter. Oh, yeah? Me, too. What's your name? Willem de Koning. What's yours? Mark Rothko. Hey, I've heard of you. I've heard of you, too. Start of a long friendship.
B. Vlade. The next day, Vlade paid a visit to his friend Rosario O'Hara, one of the old veterans of the city's subway squad. In the years when Vlade had worked for her, they had done all the usual subway work, which in those years included extending their operational reach into the drowned parts of the subway. Slow work that mostly consisted of using the train tubes as giant, water-filled utilidors, and laying within them things like conduit pipe for power lines, sewage pipes, tracks for robotic supply submersible capsules, comm cables, and so on, all the while keeping passage in them clear for maintenance access by city divers. The old Metropolitan Transit Authority and the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey had long ago split up the old jurisdictions and responsibilities, but not in any sane way, and one thing happening in the 60% of the subway system that was underwater was an ongoing power struggle between the successors to the two agencies, which also created zones of dispute and uncertainty in which more informal alliances between working teams could be created. Thus, Vlade had spent 10 years of his youth working for the LMMTA, and had strung a million miles of submersible line during that time, among other more interesting chores. All that work had been done in teams, and there was enough danger involved to make the teams like family for the time they were working together, and that feeling persisted long after the work was done. So he felt safe in calling on Rosario and asking her to meet on a taqueria raft outside the Port Authority's building on the Hudson, where they could talk as they ate, sitting at the edge of the raft. Have you heard of the Cyprus station being put to use lately? Anyone blowing it out and squatting down there? Not that I've heard. Why do you ask? Well, I was up there with some friends the other day, and their infrared caught the hot spot on the bottom, and it seemed to be coming from out of the Cyprus hole, and I thought it might be heat coming up from that stairwell. It was a common signal. Most of the drowned subway stations lofted plumes of heat up from the underworld. Submarine New York was a busy place. I don't think there's anything going on there, Rosario said. It was industrial around there, as I recall. Parking lots for cars, containers, buses, pallets. Also that row of oil tanks on the old shore. That's what I thought. But this was a hot spot. I've got a feeling that something might be going on down there. Why? I don't know. There's some people from my building missing, and some sabotage of the building, too, and it's made me spooky. Anyway, I'd like to take a look, and I think it's tricky enough I need to buddy dive it. Rosario nodded. Okay. Trina Dobson and Jim Fritch okay with you? Of course, just who I was hoping for.
I'll see when they're available. How about you?
I can get free when they can.
The group convened later that week at 86th, a station on the number 6 line up to Pelham. Vlade had been worried about surveillance of the site, and Rosario had suggested they come at it from the side, as they might have done if it were one of their old work projects in the tunnels. Vlade liked that, and Trina and Jim did too. Clearly, they were all happy to have an excuse to do the stupid thing again. No one dove the tunnels for fun, but it was fun. 86th was one of the few stations on the 6th line to remain above ground, and it gave them a place to gear up and check each other's suits. Vlade and Jim had worked together in the old days, and Vlade knew Jim was a great diver. It was good to see him again. Trina was Rosario's old partner. When they were ready, they clomped down the stairs and dove down to tube level, then got themselves arranged on the sides of a rail sled and sent it humming north. Rail sleds moved through the black water of the tunnels much more slowly than the subway trains used to, but they were still much faster than people could have swum. Rosario had all the codes and the right to log on and take a ride. They had to make sure their time at this depth was short in order to avoid having to decompress when they came up, so being able to catch a ride like this was good. It was an eerie journey, a kind of submarine dream of an old subway ride, with all of them hanging onto the sled and exposed to the hard push of black water. They looked around in different directions, and their headlamp beams fenced as they struck the tiled walls of the stations they passed through, making the walls gleam. The water in the tubes was clearer than in the rivers, and their lights hit the walls between stations and clarified the cylinder shape they were moving through. A weird sight, no matter how many times you saw it. In half an hour, the sled pulled them under the Harlem River and the Bronx Kill. Rosario stopped it in the Cypress Avenue station, and cautiously they swam up the black depths of the stairwell, the water getting murkier as they ascended. There, in the big room just under the old street level, they saw it. A shipping container, dark with crud, scarred by the lighter marks of ropes and hoist belts recently applied to its sides. It had been dropped down one of the holes that led up to the street level of old. Vlade swam toward the container and scoped it with an infrared scope they had brought along for this purpose. Yes, it was hot. When he got close, he stopped kicking and used his hands to wave himself to a stop. At one end of the container was an assemblage they all recognized, an inflatable airlock and tube staircase, covering the end of the container and standing out in the mucky surroundings because it was clean. These assemblages consisted of tubes attached to an adhesive airlock door. When the tube's walls and its interior stairs were inflated, it would rise to the surface at about a 45-degree angle, where it could be opened at the top and any water inside pumped out, thus providing a dry descent to the airlock door, which could be glued to any kind of opening. A boat or dock on the surface could then grab the free end of the tube stairs and haul it up, and by using the stairs inside the tube, make a dry entry to whatever the bottom end of the tube was glued to. A standard piece of equipment all over the harbor, very familiar to them. Rosario swam up to Vlade and spoke through their suit's walkie-talkie system.
Check it out. There's an air tank on the top next to the airlock. Water units, air and sewage, the whole shebang.
Yep.
What do you want to do?
I'm going to knock on the side and see if anyone knocks back. If that happens, I want to call the police and stay here on guard until they get here.
We should have brought our water pistols.
We did, Jim and Trina said, pointing to their swim bags.
Deploy, please, Rosario said. Okay, let's go. If this is a hostage box, there's sure to be sensors on it, so let's go fast.
Vlade finned hard to the side of the hot container. He tapped the old hello pattern, shave and a haircut, two bits, then put his ear to the side of the container. After a few moments, he heard taps back. Tip, tip, tip. Tap, tap, tap. Tip, tip, tip. A clear SOS. Maybe the only bit of Morse code left alive in the world. Call the police, he said to the others. Rosario swam up the old subway stairs toward the surface. She had radio comms in her swim bag and got the call off. They could hear it through their walkie-talkie system. A police cruiser was over them in about 15 minutes, though it felt longer. When the cruiser cut its motors, all four of them surfaced and explained what they had found. The police officers aboard had run into situations like this before. They asked the divers to go down and pull the inflatable staircase tube up to them, which Vlade and Jim did. Then they attached an air hose to the tube's valve and pumped it rigid, at which point it filled most of the old subway hole. After that, they put a water vacuum in the interior cylinder and pumped it dry. Their vacuum was nothing compared to Idelba's, but it was strong enough to quickly empty the interior of the staircase tube, which had been collapsed down below and was mostly dry to begin with. When it was cleared, two of the water officers descended into it, one carrying a welding gun and headset. After that, Vlade and the others floated by the boat, waiting. They couldn't help keeping an eye out to see if other watercraft were approaching, though with their eyes right at the water's surface, their prospect was not good. They also swam back down from time to time to make sure no submersibles were approaching. This was something they could do that the police cruiser couldn't, not optically anyway, so after a while, Vlade and Jim stayed down there by the container, looking around uneasily. Nothing came near them. They resurfaced when Rosario called them and got there just in time to see the two water cops emerge from the floating end of the inflated staircase tube, helping two bearded men make their way up the stairs. Up in the wind, the two men paused and looked around at the river, hands shielding their eyes, blinking like moles.
There's a market for markets, said Donald McKenzie.
C. That citizen. Dark pools. Dark pools of money, of financial activities, unregulated and unreported. Estimated to be three times larger than the officially reported economy. Exchanges not advertised or explained to outsiders. Exchanges opaque, even to those making them. Go into one and see what's being offered in there for less than in the regular exchanges. Buy a lot of it and hope it's what it was supposed to be. Take it out and sell it at list price. A nanosecond is a billionth of a second. Trades happen that fast. The offer on your screen is not the actual present, but represents some moment of the past. Or, if you want to say it's in the present, there are high-frequency algorithms that are working in your actionable future, in that they can act before you can. They're across a technological international dateline, working in the next present. When you offer to buy something, they can buy it first and sell it to you for more. High-frequency trading algorithms can react to a quote faster than the public actually sees it offered at all. Any trade in the dark pools is getting shaved by a high-frequency interloper. It's a stealth tax imposed on the exchanges by high-frequency trading, by the cloud itself. Rent. Liquidity vaporized. Liquidity gone through the phase change that makes it a gas. Liquidity become gaseous, become telepathy, liquidity gone metaphysical. So because of this situation, much of the movement of capital therefore now happens out of sight, unregulated, in a world of its own. Two-thirds of all finance, but this is an estimate, it could be more. Trillions of dollars a day, possibly a quadrillion dollars a day, meaning $1,000 trillion. And some people, when they want to, can pull some of this vaporized money out of the dark pools and reliquify it, then solidify it by buying things in the real economy, in the real world. This being the case, if you think you know how the world works, think again. You are deceived. You don't know. You can't see it. And the whole story has never been told to you. Sorry. Just the way it is. But if you then think furthermore that the bankers and financiers of this world know more than you do, wrong again. No one knows this system. It grew in the dark. It's a stack, a hyperobject, an accidental megastructure. No single individual can know any one of these megastructures, much less the mega-megastructure that is the global system entire, the system of all systems. The bankers, when they're young, they're traders. They grab a tiger by the tail and ride it wherever it goes, proclaiming that they are piloting a hydrofoil, expert overconfidence. As they age out, a good percentage of them have made their pile, feel in their guts, literally, how burned out they are, and go away and do something else. Finance is not a lifelong vocation. Some small percentage of financiers turn into monster sages and are accounted wise men, but even they are not. The people hacking around in the jungle aren't in good position to see the terrain. And they're not great thinkers anyway. HFM, the anonymous hedge fund manager who spilled Diary of a Very Bad Year, was a fluke, an intellectual working in a trade. When he understood, he left, because there are very few ideas uptown. And even the great thinkers can't learn it all. They are ignorant too. They bail on the details of the emergent situation, unknowable in any case, and after that they write or talk impressionistically. They are over-impressed by Nietzsche, a very great philosopher but an erratic writer, veering between brilliance and nonsense sentence by sentence, giving cover for similar belletristic claptrap ever since. His imitators at their best end up sounding like Rimbaud, who quit writing at age 19. And no matter the pseudo-profundities of one's prose style, it's a system that can't be known. It's too big, too dark, too complex. You are lost in a prison of your own device, in the labyrinth, submerged deeply in the dark pools. Speaking of belletristic claptrap. There are other dark pools in New York Bay, however. They lie under the eelgrass at the mouths of the city's creeks, deeper than any algorithm can plumb. Because life is more than algorithmic. It's a snarl of green fuses, an efflorescence of vitalisms. Nothing we devise is anything like as complex as the Bay's ecosystem. On the floors of the canals, the old sewer holes spew life from below. Up and down life floats, in and out with the tides. Salamanders and frogs and turtles proliferate among the fishes and eels, burrow in the mulm. Above them birds flock and nest in the concrete cliffs of the city, beneficiaries of the setback laws for skyscrapers that were in force between 1916 and 1985. Right whales swim into the upper bay to birth their babies. Mink whales, finbacks, humpbacks, wolves and foxes skulk in the forests of the outer boroughs. Coyotes walk across the uptown plazas at 3 a.m., lords of the cosmos. They prey on the deer, always numerous everywhere, and avoid the skunks and porcupines who stroll around scarcely molested by anyone. Bobcats and pumas hide like the wild cats they are, and the feral ex-domestic cats are infinite in number. The Canada lynx? I call it the Manhattan lynx. It feasts on New England cottontails, on snowshoe hares, muskrats, and water rats. At the center of the estuary network swims the mayor of the municipality, the beaver, busily building wetlands. Beavers are the real estate developers. River otters, mink, fishers, weasels, raccoons, all these citizens inhabit the world the beavers made from their version of lumber. Around them swim harbor seals, harbor porpoises. A sperm whale sails through the narrows like an ocean liner, squirrels and bats, the American black bear. They have all come back like the tide. Like poetry, in fact, please take over, O ghost of glorious Walt. Because life is robust. Because life is bigger than equations, stronger than money, stronger than guns and poison and bad zoning policy, stronger than capitalism. Because Mother Nature bats last, and Mother Ocean is strong, and we live inside our mothers forever, and life is tenacious, and you can never kill it, you can never buy it. So life is going to dive down into your dark pools. Life is going to explode the enclosures and bring back the commons. Oh, you dark pools of money and law and quantitudinal stupidity. You oversimple algorithms of greed. You desperate simpletons hoping for a story you can understand. Hoping for safety, hoping for cessation of uncertainty, hoping for ownership of volatility. Oh, you poor, fearful jerks. Life, 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 life is going to kick your ass.
Will Irwin. To the European, these colossi seem either banal, meaningless, the sinister proof of a material civilization, or a startling new achievement in art. And I have often wondered whether it does not all depend upon the first glimpse. Whether at the moment when he stampedes to the rail, they appear as a jumble, like boxes piled on boxes, or fall into one of their super compositions. Pedestrian killed by a cornice falling off a building.
D. Inspector Jen. Inspector Jen got a call from Vlade at around 4 that afternoon.
Hey, we found those guys who were snatched from the farm.
Did you? Where were they?
Up in the Bronx. I was up there doing some salvage work when we saw a hot spot down in the Cypress subway station. So I went back with some of my old city sub friends and dived it and got an SOS from people inside a container down there, and a police boat cracked it and pulled them out.
Really? Jen said. Where are they now?
At the police dock station, at 123. Can you meet them there?
Sure can. My pleasure. I've been worried about those guys.
Me too.
Good job.
Good luck, you mean. But we'll take it, right?
You bet. After they're checked out, I'll see if I can bring them home with me. Hey, do you think they can fit back in that hotelo with the old man?
I can set up another one for Hexter, right next to theirs.
Sounds good. See you tonight. Jen made arrangements for a water launch and asked Sergeant Olmsted to come with her. She piloted the cruiser up to the police station at 123rd and Frederick Douglass, taking Madison most of the way north and using some police boat privilege to pop through the intersections. At the station, they found the two kidnapped victims recovering in the infirmary. Two middle-aged men. They had already showered and were wearing issue civvies. One of them, Ralph Muttchop, brown hair thinning on top, about 6 foot, hound dog face, skinny except for a slight pot belly, sat in a chair drinking coffee, looking around with a wary expression. The other, Jeffrey Rosen, small, feral, triangular head covered with tight black curls, lay on an infirmary bed with an IV in his forearm. He was running his other hand through his hair and talking a mile a minute to the other people in the room. Jen sat and inserted some questions into his nervous chatter. It quickly became clear they would not be able to do much to dispel the mystery of their disappearance. They'd been knocked out by whoever grabbed them, probably some milk of amnesia involved, as they had no memories of the abduction. After that, they'd lived in their container, fed two meals a day, they guessed, through a Judas slot in their door. Rosen had gotten sick at some point, and Muttchop had left messages on their food trays telling their captors about this. And meals after that had included some pills, which Jeff had taken. More memory confusion at this point suggested more milk of amnesia. They had never seen or heard anything of their captors.
How long were we in there? Jeff asked.
Jen consulted her pad.
89 days.
The two men regarded each other round-eyed. Finally, Muttchop shook his head.
Felt like longer, he said. It felt like, I don't know, a couple years.
I'm sure it did, Jen said.
Listen, when you're cleared medically here, can I give you a ride home? Everyone at the Met has been worried about you.
That will be good, Jeff said. Jen left Olmsted there to guard them, warning the sergeant and the cops on duty there to take care. It was at least possible that the kidnappers had stuck trackers in them and might try to grab them back, or worse. She ordered thorough scans for such devices, then left and piloted the cruiser back down to Central Park North Dock, and walked to the federal building behind the big police docks at 5th and 110th. By this time, it was sunset, and the sunlight was lancing through the great towers to the west, silhouetting them like a dragon's back against a bronze sky. Jen walked into the Fed building, got through security, and went to the office where the Federal Department of Immigration, the FBI, the NYPD, and the Householders Union had combined to create a human smuggling task force. Here she found an old acquaintance from her first days in the force, Goran Rajan, who greeted her cheerfully and poured her a cup of tea. Jen described the situation with her two rescued ones.
"Only two," Goran repeated.
"That's right."
"And they were kept for 8 or 9 days?"
"That's right."
Goran shook his head.
"So this isn't smuggling. It's some kind of kidnapping. Was a ransom demanded at any point?"
"Nothing. No one involved seems to know why it happened."
"Not the victims?"
"Well, I haven't debriefed them fully yet. They lived in my building and were abducted from it. So I've been taking a personal interest. I'll give them a ride home tonight and ask more questions."
"Good that you take this over, because we often find 100 people in one of those containers. Your guys are not really in our realm."
"I understand. But I was hoping you would check through your harbor surveillance data and see if you can spot anyone visiting this container to feed these guys. It was probably twice daily visits."
Goran sipped tea.
"I can try. If they were coming from the surface, we'll probably see it. If it was being done by robot subs, less likely."
"How many cameras do you have deployed now?"
"It's a few million. The limiting factor these days is the analysis. I'll try to figure out some questions and see what I can find."
"Thanks," Jen said.
"Remember, the kidnappers will know their hostages are gone. They'll probably leave the area."
"That might not be a bad thing," Jen said.
"No. May I ask if you are expecting me to find anything in particular?"
"I've been finding stuff that makes me wonder about Pinscher Pinkerton."
"Okay. They're big. They have all the drones and subs you'd need to do the visits automatically. It's possible this whole procedure was done remotely."
"Still, you might at least see the drones." Jen finished her tea and rose to leave.
"Thanks, Goran. When can I expect a report?"
"Soon. The computers answer the moment you finish your question. So it's a matter of having the questions to ask."
Jen thanked him and went back to her cruiser and headed back to the Frederick Douglass station. There she found Muttchopf and Rosen ready to leave, and she and Olmsted escorted them onto the cruiser and headed down the East River toward home. The two men sat in chairs on the bridge beside Jen as she stood, piloting, looking at the city like tourists. The tallest towers behind them still reflected some of the glow of twilight, though it was night overhead, the clouds a noctilucent pink. The lights of the dusky city bounced and shattered in the wakes on the water.
"You must be kind of blown away," Jen supposed. 3 months is a long time to be locked up."
The two men nodded.
"It was a sensory deprivation tank," Rosen said. "You're now this."
Muttchopf nodded.
"It's beautiful," he said. "The city."
"It's cold," Jeff added, shivering. "But it smells good."
"It smells like dinner,"
Muttchopf declared.
"A New York seafood dinner."
"Low tide," Jen pointed out. "But we'll get you something to eat when we get home."
"That sounds good," Rosen said. "Finally. I'm finally beginning to get my appetite back."
At the Met, they got off on the dock, and Jen had Olmsted run the cruiser back to the station. Vlade greeted them, and he and Jen escorted the two men to the dining hall. They were weak. In the dining hall, they were offered the chance to sit and be served, but both of them wanted to go through the serving line and choose their food. They heaped their plates high and poured themselves glasses of the Flatiron's Red And as they ate and drank, Jen sat across from them asking questions about the night of their abduction. They nodded, shook their heads, shrugged, said little. Then, with a look around, Muttchopf said to her, "How about you come up with us to our place when you're done here?" She nodded and waited for them to finish. Eventually, they said they were stuffed, and Jeff was looking sleepy. They took the elevator up to the farm floor and went to the southeast corner. There they found two hotellos, a small one next to the larger one. Mr. Hexter came out to greet his new neighbors. The two men shook hands with him politely, but clearly they were beat. They ducked into their hotello and looked around dumbly. "Home sweet home," Rosen said, and went immediately to his cot bed and lay down on his back. Muttchopf sat in the chair by his cot. "I see your pads are gone," he noted, gesturing at the single plastic desk. "Ah," Jen said. "Anything else missing?"
"Don't know yet. We didn't have much."
"So," Jen said, "you seem to be indicating that there was something you wanted to talk to me about." Muttchopf nodded.
"Look, the night we were snatched, Jeff here activated a covert channel he had inserted into one of the high-frequency trading cables of a company we've worked for a few times. He sent off some instructions. He was trying to amend the trading rules and the state of the world, I guess you'd say, by a direct fix. Shunt some information and money to the SEC, do some whistleblowing. I'm not sure what else. He had a whole program, but the point bite was probably what caught someone's attention. It could have looked like an ordinary theft, or maybe whistleblowing. Anyway, very soon after he pushed the button on that, as far as we can remember, we were knocked out. It was almost too fast to be a response, but then again, my memory of it is fuzzy. Maybe it was a couple hours, who can say? But for sure, that same night.
And who were you working for when this happened?
No one. We lost our jobs. We were gigging.
Jen took this in. You weren't working for Henry Vincent. Rosen looked surprised at this.
He's my cousin. We worked for him before.
I know. I mean, we saw that in your records. Muttchopf spoke when it became clear Rosen wasn't going to.
We did work for him, yeah. And that was where Jeff put in his tap in his cousin's company's dark pool diver. And that's also who he did a little whistleblowing on. But we weren't working for him that night. We were fired before that.
He has always been an asshole, Rosen said bitterly. Jen watched them closely. When was this, and what happened? Muttchopf had to tell the story. 3 years earlier, a stint with Adirondack, where Vincent had been CEO. Questionable work there, rigging dark pools. Later, a gig for Alban Albany, Vincent's company. It was only work for hire, a contract. But they had signed non-disclosure agreements, as always. While doing the job, Jeff had found evidence of malfeasance and taken it to his cousin. They had argued. Then Jeff and Mutt had been fired. This, combined with the loss of their apartment to the watery shallows, had started them on their wandering around Lower Manhattan, leading to their arrival at the Met. "He was cheating again," Jeff added when Mutt had finished. "Fucking sleazebag that he is."
"What do you mean?" Jen asked.
Jeff just shook his head, too disgusted to speak. Muttchopf's lips were pulsing in and out as he regarded Jen, apparently assessing her level of financial acumen.
"It was a dark pool version of front-running," he said. "Say you get an order for something at 100. Immediately you go out and buy it for yourself at 100 in the hope that that will drive up the price, meanwhile not fulfilling the first order. If the price then goes up to 103, you sell what you bought while telling the person who made the order that you couldn't find a buyer. If, on the other hand, it goes down to 98, you fulfill the order at 100. Either way, you're good. There's no way to lose.
Nice, Jen said.
But illegal,
Jeff said, still disgusted.